Good morning, everybody. Today is Monday, February the 1st. What is going on here, Mr. Watson? This is not right.
Well, it's not raining. That's a problem.
It's not raining. I saw sun, and it's in February already.
Yeah, I wouldn't hold your breath too much longer, but we'll take it when we can get it at the moment. I'm sure we need the water up in the hills.
Oh, I don't mind the rain. That's okay. It's just the torrential downpour part that kind of throws me every once in a while. Oh, are you ready for our Ever Wonder Why?
You know, I think today I'm just going to listen and not try to answer.
Well, this one...
I'm here to learn today, Brian.
This one you might have a shot at. Ever wonder why people shake hands to show friendship?
Well, I'm sure you're about to tell us. Does
it
have something to do with knights and a sign that you're not a threat?
Yeah, See, today is a good day for you. In very early times, most men carried weapons and wielded them in their right hands. When a man wanted to show another that he wished to be friendly, he extended an empty right hand, showing that it contained no weapon. Then, to make absolutely sure neither man could suddenly reach for a weapon, each man grasped the hand of the other and held it firmly until each was sure he was dealing with a friend. The actual shaking of the hand may have been done for purposes of dislodging any weapons hidden in the sleeves. See?
Yeah, well, one, I think that biologically lefties would have an advantage that would have came through since then, you know, because they can wield the weapon while your good hand's taken. And secondly, I think the shaking probably has to do with the typical male, you know, who's stronger than who, testosterone thing.
The grip.
Right, the grip. It's about the grip.
Or who has the fishiest, weakest handshake, too. Does that frustrate you when you meet somebody and it's kind of like the wet noodle?
Yeah, it makes me want to dry my hands off immediately afterwards.
Yeah, exactly. Hey, saw a couple of different instances since we've been together last where EPD and Sheriff were making a joint stop, response, something along those lines. How often when you're responding to something, do other agencies help out and vice versa? How often do you guys help out, like the sheriff or the CHP, when they're responding to an event within your neighborhood?
It's a constant thing, probably at least weekly, if not daily at some level. It could be as simple as you're driving through town, you do a traffic stop, and the officer has a traffic stop, and a sheriff's deputy or a CHP officer pulls in behind them to, you know, to help out to an incident like, you know, a SWAT call out where we have a multi-agency county team with members from most major law enforcement agencies or the drug task force, for example. We each have members on those units, which really help further that collaboration and that partnership. So when you're in an isolated rural county like this with, yeah, you know, ballpark, I don't know, 300 officers or so in here, you deeply rely on each other because we just don't have the resources. So if it's a large protest, it's a barricaded, you know, standoff with the suspect, the pursuit that goes wrong, I mean, the list goes on and on, you know, we're there to help each other out. And those partnerships are absolutely crucial, and they make Humboldt County a lot more safe.
Well, on a less lesser scale, I guess, on a smaller scale, chasing somebody who's speeding or is trying to get away. I mean, something that's a little bit more pedestrian. Will you ask for assistance, or will everybody kind of be monitoring each other? And if you've got somebody who's in, let's say, 4 or 5 blocks away, they'll respond just because that's the right thing to do.
You know, a lot of that depends. Those kind of very routine, more minor assistances may depend on where you work. For instance, Arcata and Humboldt State University have a very close partnership because the college is located in the city, essentially. And so I'm sure they back each other frequently. The sheriff's office and CHP rely upon each other quite a bit, and even Fish and Game, BLM, and some other, you know, federal units, because you may be an hour from the nearest major city out there, you know, solo deputy or solo CHP officer. And so they are monitoring the scanner. The dispatch centers are connected with each other very quickly. And it's very common to get support and backup in those kind of situations. versus in the city of Eureka, most days we have enough staff on hand that we can manage most of the situations that come our way. Sometimes we do call for mutual aid, and it's obviously very appreciated in those cases. You know, long or large, protracted scene, a major scene, you're going to need help.
I love your reference of major city. You know, those with references in smaller burgs, yeah, I kind of can appreciate it, but I'm thinking of the folks that have relocated here from, let's say, Santa Rosa South.
Yeah, I'm going to be curious to see what the demographics are about a year from now, how much COVID may have contributed to a migration north to an area that's, well, just not a major city.
Yeah, well, I'm kind of halfway curious the combination between the virus and the fires. The two together,
right.
I think, have probably pushed people, whether it was this past year's fires or the preceding year's fires. I wonder if they
sure
track that stuff.
I don't know. If they get some kind of assistance related to disaster relief, maybe. I don't know if that's something DHHS might have some figures on, or it's a great question.
Or the real estate folks.
You should put Winston on it.
Well, you woke him up with that comment, Steve, so thank you.
I try to help out mutual aid, you know.
Yeah. He's still a little perplexed, but I'm not sure the mutual was a kumbaya moment on that one. It certainly was worth fun. And I think I'll reach out to a couple of real estate buddies and see if they have any kind of tracking, either previous residents or if there's some just a basic questionnaire of some sort. KINS, News and Information Time, it's 8:19.
Listen to 980 AM for the best music, ABBA, Neil Diamond, Barbara Streisand, Billy Joel, and the Fifth Dimension. The all-time best are heard every day, all day long on 980 AM. We are easy radio, easy on your ears and easy on your mind. This is memory-making music, and you'll love the memories you create. Tune in and hear the best music, easy radio, 980 AM.
Good morning, KINS, News and Information Time is 8:24. We're back talking shop this morning with Eureka Police Chief Steve Watson. Steve, you had mentioned that, as far as response where multiple agencies involved, you mentioned the Drug Task Force specifically, and I think probably a fair amount of our listeners are familiar with that just because we've talked about it over the decades. But what are some of the other behind-the-scenes things that we don't really see in the general community where there is the partnering going together with the various law enforcement agencies in the area? I mean, I think the only other thing we might be aware of is that the chiefs get together once a month and talk about whatever it is you guys talk about.
Right. That's the Law Enforcement Chiefs Association of Humboldt County, LECA. And we do meet monthly and collaborate and share information, which is another one of those partnerships. You know, in terms of formal entities, the Drug Task Force is one of the big ones next to the Humboldt County multi-agency SWAT team, and that's also an important collaboration, again, led ultimately by the Sheriff's Office, but with major contributions from several different agencies in the county, including the Eureka Police Department. I think Fortuna and Arcata have members on there and some others, so it provides more manpower and resources. We get the benefit of highly trained officers that work daily with our departments as well, and the ability to call for assistance from the SWAT team if we have a major incident in Eureka that really isn't something that patrol can or should handle. So you could have an armed, barricaded subject, for instance. Now, you can't hit the SWAT button for just anything, but there's a matrix or a risk matrix that they go through that kind of assesses whether it triggers a SWAT call out or not. Sometimes those fall in the gray area or on the bubble, and that's where the conversations between the leadership, between the agencies is also really critical.
Yeah, I would think that you wouldn't want to have them coming out for a traffic stop, you know, regardless of what the situation was. But can the SWAT team be brought out as a preventative rather than as a reactive?
It would really depend on the circumstances. You know, you don't want to roll the bear cup out just any situation, obviously.
Right.
But, yeah, that's an interesting. I'd have to try to think of a scenario where that might apply. Usually SWAT is for those high-risk situations.
I'm thinking something like a visiting dignitary, or if there had been rumors of violence associated with either an individual or an event. Would they come out,
yeah,
or are there other teams that would be prior to that one?
In some ways, all of the above, but yes, an example, I believe, is the guy that in Weaverville made some threats to show up on Inauguration Day and shoot anyone that he and his quote-unquote friend saw wearing masks, as well as one of our county government departments. And so, you know, there was a tactical team on standby for that. They may not have been parked right out in the middle of the street. We had other officers that were doing and deputies that were fulfilling those rules. But if something were to have happened, we were ready to rock and roll.
Let's backpedal there just a wee little bit, Camper. You said somebody had threatened to shoot anybody wearing masks on a certain day?
Yes. So I don't know if you read about the arrest that we made after serving search warrants in the middle of the night on the, I believe it was 19th, 20th. But there was a male who's currently living in Eureka, city limits, who made some threatening statements to a restaurant owner in Weaverville. He was just come back from the festivities in Washington at the Capitol. It's my understanding he showed up late to that party, so to speak, and may not have been part of that, but that's being researched. But he drove back, had a conversation with someone in Weaverville. I believe it was over being confronted for not wearing his own mask inside a business. Made some statements that the owner felt were highly threatening, to the degree that she didn't even come to work the next day, I heard. And she immediately reported it to Trinity County law enforcement. It made it to the Emergency Operations Center, the JIC, Joint Information Center here in Humboldt, the Sheriff's Office, the EPD. We all worked together, including with our DA's office, to look at, hey, what laws did he violate? You know, will we prosecute? Can we charge him? The answer was yes on felony terrorist / criminal threats. So then the hunt was on to find out exactly where he was at in Eureka. And we confirmed that he, in fact, was here, was living here, at least temporarily. Found him, used a ruse to get him out because of the potential danger involved of the location where he was at. I'm not going to share the ruse in case we have to use it against you.
Right.
Sometime, Brian, but, took him into custody. He was actually peaceful and cooperative with the officers, served the search warrant, didn't find any live weapons or ammunition at the time. He is a prohibited felon. He minimized some of the statements, but did put himself in Weaverville. We're assessing the case now. We still have some the results of the analysis of some electronic devices that the FBI is helping us to uncover. I believe cell phones may be involved to see if there's any additional information or evidence there. So that's still pending. But in the meanwhile, he was arrested for felony threats, and his threats were essentially, per the witness, that you know, he was upset. He was going to show up in Eureka with some of his friends. They were going to essentially shoot anyone that they saw as they went down the street that was wearing a mask, and also made specific threats reportedly to shoot up a specific department within the county that actually generated a lot of understandable fear, a lot of contingency plans, extra safety plans. And we had officers there first thing in the morning, for instance, even after he was in custody, just out of an abundance of caution. So either he had that intent and means to actually carry it out, we're still investigating that, but it was clear that he made statements that were taken seriously and ultimately conveyed this threat of, you know, an active shooter in our town.
KINS, News and Information Time, it's 8:30.
Hey, community. Times are rough right now. Retail shops may be closing, but the bulk flower market is still open and moving fast. we here at Bayer can help turn your flower harvest into cash today. Call Bayer Extraction House at 707-693-2222. That's 707-693-2222. Don't miss out. It is time to sell. Bayer Extraction House, your flower selling powerhouse.
Good morning, KINS News and Information Times, 8:35. Good morning. Welcome to February. And Mr. Steve Watson's alongside this morning. Talk Shop presented by CDH Painting, Redeck, Humboldt Termite and Pest Control, Murphy's Markets, and Baywood Golf and Country Club. Steve, as we consider some of the different elements that are out there, you know, you in the last segment you kind of profiled what happened or gave us an overview of what happened with the fellow that you guys took care of in a couple weeks ago. There was a reference made to and friends. I would suspect that that's as challenging for you, for the FBI, for anybody dealing with a threat, is that if there is and friends, that really puts, you know, the tentacles out into a whole bunch of areas that may or may not be as easy to take care of.
It definitely was an extra layer of concern, because even once we had him into custody and I could call that department level director and let him know, and he could let his staff know, and everyone could take a breath, just out of an abundance of caution, especially in today's kind of extremist environment and the highly charged nature of things right now, we couldn't presume there wasn't others, maybe. And because, again, we still had more work to do, and so we still had extra officers and deputies out in safety plans in case. Now, it turned out we didn't find any evidence whatsoever of, others, the others that were referred to, according to the witness. But, you know, it is concerning, because there's definitely evidence, if you look at what happened on January 6th, Capitol, that there was some pre-planning by at least some groups involved. And I look at the plot to kidnap a governor that happened earlier that year. I mean, that's insanity. And I know the federal government is very worried about homegrown extremists at this point. I've been reading into intel bulletins to come in. We're hearing a lot more about that than foreign terrorists. So, of course, that's something we always have to safeguard against. And so I'm hoping that things went way too far in anyone's book.
And hasn't there been some rumblings about, I think, was it this morning in one of the newscasts, some rumblings about people making threats against California governor and his family and his business holdings?
You know, I didn't read that. I'm sure I'll get information on that if it comes in. But I think that in this current climate, they're all going to need to be, I mean, they're already vigilant, because you draw a certain type of person when you're in a position of prominent leadership like that. And of course, no one's ever going to be happy with all of your decisions or politics either. And that throws, you know, even more, onto the fire, so to speak. But again, they have had some very real credible threats across the country to leaders, and have really had to up their game in terms of protection and vigilance, and also reaching out not only at the federal level, but at the state and local level, just to, you know, they want information. If you get information, send it in. You know, they have a process, a system, to collect all of that and to dissect it and to distribute it and to act on it if necessary.
That's what I was going to ask. If there's a threat more than just, I guess, beyond the goofball stage, okay? So it has the potential of maybe being viable. Do rural law enforcement agencies get notification about that stuff, even if it's 1,000 miles away, 700 miles away, 500 miles away?
It depends on the type of information and the need to control it. Some of this stuff needs to be kept highly confidential and close, almost need to know for various reasons. But in a broader sense, yes, we regularly get, reports from these, I'll just put it this way, these intelligence clearinghouses that exist that have been created, to disseminate information across all levels of law enforcement. And so we will hear about some of these, because these trends are, it's important to understand and recognize trends that are out there in certain groups that may not be located just in one state. They could have active chapters, for instance, in California to New York. And so you got to know who the players are. You got to know what their goals are. You have to know what their method of operating are, so you can be vigilant and part of a nationwide system to protect our country against these threats, foreign and domestic.
So it makes it a little bit more challenging. Now, when it's through the air, you have TSA working for you. It kind of is not mediators, but certainly as a screening or a filtering potentially. If it's people driving around, I would suspect that it shifts that area of knowledge gathering to somebody else. Or is there anybody else?
Well, we don't speed dial TSA to come out and help us with potential
shooter. Right, exactly. That's, yeah.
You know, again, it's just so important. That was one of the lessons learned from 9/11, is you had all these different intelligence organizations and they weren't necessarily always talking to each other or in a timely and effective manner. And we're still, quite frankly, probably have too many alphabet soup entities out there, but some lessons were learned and the need to not make the same mistakes again. And that's obviously a fair bit out of the normal local arena that we operate in here. I'm not directly involved in federal efforts other than as a local community partner. But, again, there are these systems in place, these agencies that have various areas and arenas of responsibility. And it'd be interesting to get some input from an insider out there, what their frustrations are, because I know there are still some with how the system is working, or maybe I should say not always working.
Do you think one of the residuals of having the Joint Information Center up and functional, well, quote-unquote functional, for a year is going to be continued communication between the various law enforcement and department heads?
I think that the JIC is more oriented right now towards the COVID pandemic response.
Sure.
For a time, the fire, some of the things like that, versus the criminal side of the house, though obviously they did receive information and it did work here locally. It's very scalable. But we're tied in on the national scale through a regional joint information centers that exist for this purpose, not necessarily located in Humboldt County, but in our northern region.
Gotcha.
And then we have some active members of these intel entities here locally. For instance, Fortuna PD has a fantastic person that is a clearinghouse and of information that's coming in. We have someone designated in my department that's going to be going to some training and be involved with that as well. I mean, the other agencies do. So each agency has somebody that's designated to be involved with that function. I was emailing somebody yesterday from Fortuna that's involved, for them, very heavily involved in this, and does a fantastic job of communicating two-way this information here locally, because we are a little isolated up here.
KINS, News and Information Time, it's 8:43.
The Redwood Region Economic Development Commission wants you to know that local economic development agencies, business resource organizations, financial institutions, and jurisdictions are working together to provide resources for the COVID-19 pandemic. For more information, go to northcoastsbdc.org or call the OES Business Hotline at 268-2527. 268-2527.
Good morning, KINS, News and Information Time. It's 8:47. We are back talking shop this morning with Eureka Police Chief Steve Watson. Steve, today also marks for our neighbors north of us in Oregon that, well, I guess in theory we could have our neighbors south of us in Oregon too if somebody's listening to the internet, but let's go with the majority here and say neighbors to the north. Legalization or decriminalization, and I know there's a technical difference, but for most of us on the street, it's kind of seen as interchangeable, of heroin, LSD, meth, all kinds of the nasties that have been, well, you mentioned the Drug Task Force, have been all part of, some of the things that they have been chasing down for a long, long time. Do you fear any ripples coming into Humboldt County or, on the other hand, going out of Humboldt County?
Absolutely. And, you know, I really want to watch Oregon closely over the next couple of years to see how their experiment works out for them. I think you can learn important lessons. I think the majority of law enforcement officials, myself included, have been looking at this with great concern. Right now, I feel that it's a big mistake. Now, I don't believe that basic possession and use, I mean, your average user that may be struggling with substance abuse disorder or whatever needs to go to prison. I don't think that we're at a place where it's the right thing to do to strengthen penalties for them, but I think we should, if anything, continue to really drill down on the dealers, especially the major dealers that narcotic traffickers bringing it into the country, bringing it across our freeways and highways into our communities, and even the local level dealers that are peddling that poison. I still believe there has to be some level of consequence for possession and use, but it really should be geared more towards how can we break this cycle? How can we get upstream of the problem and get people off this poison and moving forward with their lives, because it's so incredibly destructive, not only in destroyed lives, families, relationships, theft in our community, for instance. I mean, it is a multi-billion dollar problem. And I do think we need to adjust tactics. What worked in the 80s didn't really work. You know, long term, we need to continue to look at ways to adjust. But going full out with saying it's not a crime at all to possess these very dangerous drugs, what message does that send? What leverage do we have if we find somebody in possession of a dangerous drug to get them to take that step they're unwilling or unable on their own to get into treatment? And so having all these tools available, I think, is important. Do I think someone that gets caught with a user amount, should they spend a bunch of time in jail or go to prison? No, I don't believe that anymore. Not on a simple surface.
It will be interesting. Hopefully we won't see it in the next couple of days that immediately, but I'm sure the trends will be there. And hopefully our friends in Del Norte County are ready for it also. Thanks for coming by, Steve.
All right. Take care, everyone.
Happy February. See everybody tomorrow.